Welcome to the Head Ballet Podcast. This is the place to come to hear my guests discuss with me, Paul Abbott, their favourite novelty songs. The funny, the weird, the daft, and the outright baffling tunes that have been skipping and dancing around in their heads for years. Everybody loves something that could be considered novel, so why not celebrate it? So, we're back for what I'm calling Season 2. Thanks to everyone who said lovely things about the show and basically told me to get on with it and do some new episodes. Thank you. If you could now say some lovely things on the podcast apps and give the show a review and a nice, I don't know, 5-star rating, then hopefully we'll be able to reach the ears of some more people. This time round, for my own sanity, I'm not having a fixed release schedule of every week or every 10 days or whatever. Instead, the episodes will be coming out as and when they're done. But if you're desperate for a regular fix of my voice and you don't actually live in my house, then can I point you towards the podcast The Big Beatles Sort Out, which is my brother's show on which I am the Beatles fact wrangler and generally exasperated cynic at the whole concept. That comes out every Monday and you can find it on all the usual podcast apps and at @big_sort on Twitter. If you want to get in touch with this show, then look up @headballetpod on Twitter or Instagram, or use the same name at gmail.com if you want to drop me an email. My first guest for 2021 and this new season is pop obsessive, playwright and regular podcast contributor Catherine Lowe. You might have heard Catherine on other great podcasts such as Looks Unfamiliar with Tim Worthington and the Betamax Video Club, where she's recently looked at Prince's Purple Rain movie. And she'll soon be on an episode of the Coppola Connections podcast talking about Saturday Night Fever. Catherine's theatre career has included her being a new Welsh playwright of 2016 at the Sherman Theatre, and she's also had work performed in places such as the Vaults and the Old Red Lion Theatre in London. I'm really pleased Catherine is here for episode 1 for the series, as she's picked something that's perfect for the show. It's obscure, it's funny, it's intriguing, and it deserves to be better known. So, here we go then. Head Ballet Podcast Season 2 starts now. One of the joys of doing this Head Ballet podcast is coming across stuff that I've never heard before. And I don't necessarily mean stuff that I sort of know of, but stuff I've genuinely never heard of by artists who I know absolutely nothing about. And Catherine, I think your choice is definitely in that area. So would you like to tell everyone, to kick us off, what it is that you've brought along as your pick today for the Head Ballet podcast?
Yeah, of course. This is a single called You've Got to Be a Hustler If You Want to Get On, by a woman called Sue Wilkinson, and it got to number 25 in the UK charts in August of 1980.
Oh, you've got to be a hustler if you want to get on. Principles can only hold you back. The only women making it are women who are shaking it, forsaking all their morals on the mat. It's an act, that's a fact. You've got to be a hustler if you want to make a name. Being good can only get you hurt. Chastity and virtue never bought a woman fame, and men will always crave a cunning flirt.
How did you come across it? Where did you first experience this?
I think the first time I will have been introduced to this song properly was rather predictably when I was watching the Top of the Pops reruns on BBC Four. Mm. And there was something about it that really jumped out at me, not just because of its uniqueness, but because it's very theatrical. And theatre's always been quite a big thing in my life. Been a big theatre goer for a very long time, and I've also worked in the industry, and there's something about this song that has that kind of very verbal, quite, you know, witty style to it that reminds me a little bit of kind of Noel Coward or Oscar Wilde or something out of a Sondheim musical. It has that very heightened feeling about it, and you really don't see that kind of style on Top of the Pops very much when you're watching those old episodes, and you wouldn't see it now either.
No, indeed. And so the first thing that I did when I was researching this is look it up, just a general search in Google. And of course, the Top of the Pops performance is something that you very quickly turn up at. In fact, there's two performances, and we can get into that in a little bit. And it is a very unique sounding thing. It's got trappings of the era that it's recorded and released in, but it really does stand alone.
It really does, doesn't it?
Yeah, it's a very intriguing thing. facts and figures then. Like you say, it got to number 25.
Yeah.
And it was on a label called Cheapskate, catalogue number Cheap 2.
Yeah.
First charted in August of 1980. And yeah, it's in the charts in the top 100 for 8 weeks. And that was her only hit. I mean, she released other stuff, but that was her only hit. And what we really need to get into is why was this a hit? And it's because I find it's a genuinely baffling thing. And to try and describe the sound of it, it's so sparse.
Yeah.
But then there's so much going on in the vocal.
Completely.
So could you try and describe it to someone? If you were trying to describe this to someone for the first time, what would you say?
Okay, so, well, it's sung from the point of view of a woman recalling a girl that she knew called Sally during her childhood, used to live nearby and have a lot of boyfriends. And the woman singing it lets us know that her own mother disapproved of Sally and wanted her own daughter to be very different, and warned her that if she behaved like Sally, then she'd be considered maybe as a bit of a slut, shall we say, or end up miserable and penniless. And then she tells us that she's now bumped into grown-up Sally in the local deli, and that she's now rich and living the high life, and she has plenty of lovers.
Now I saw Sally on the deli today. She's a lady now in every way. So darn rich, though they tell me she's a witch with lovers by the score. Do I have to tell you more? Oh, you've got to be a hustler.
You get the sense that the protagonist is feeling rather bitter, maybe a bit jealous, and maybe the people in the local community are too. I don't know what you think, but yeah. I sort of pick up on that kind of feeling. And then the song kind of goes on to generalize a little bit more about some of these women that are kind of, you know, kind of cheating the system that it's been set up around them. And they're these quite skilled manipulators, and they're managing to make a name for themselves in an industry that's quite difficult to get into. And they do that by marrying men and then divorcing them and then writing a book about it. And a film gets made of the book. And I think maybe the reason that it was a hit is that I do think the chorus is really killer. I think it's quite sort of Dorothy Parker. And it really sticks with you once you paid it attention. And but I also think there's something about the theme of the song that kind of chimes with a feeling that was going on at the time about sort of women feeling a bit disillusioned with the roles that they've been assigned, maybe, and the kind of, you know, structure of society. I mean, one thing that's really interesting about that Top of the Pops performance, I don't know whether it's the first one or the second one, it's the one where she's wearing the incredible pastel jumpsuit, is that you have, who is it that introduces it? Roger Daltrey introduces her, and he introduces her by saying, yeah, you know, we've got some lovely birds on the show tonight. And
here's a really lovely one with a cleaned up version of You've Got to Be a Hustler If You Want to Get On, Sue Wilkinson.
And it's, you know, it's so funny because he's, you know, he's introducing this incredibly biting kind of satirical song, but he's sort of showing us unintentionally in the way he introduces it kind of the setting in which, you know, some of this kind of anger was building up around, you know. And then you also have Legs and Co performing during that episode, and, you know, obviously we all might have kind of different feelings about what we think is good or bad about the way kind of women were used in episodes of Top of the Pops back then. But yeah, there's something about the context of it, of that Top of the Pops performance, that's really interesting. I don't know what you thought about that.
Well, there's two performances which are very interesting. We have the pastel jumpsuit one, where she's essentially stood stock still. She's got a knee up on a chair.
Yeah.
And we have a drummer and we have a keyboard player. And there's another performance where she's wearing slightly more shiny trousers, and it's a bit more vision mixed and peculiar, where we also have the drummer and the keyboard player there. But I mean, she's a very striking figure as well, though, because she's got this, what looks like acres of hair.
Yeah.
It's, you know, very, it's like Farrah Fawcett turned up.
Yes, I wrote to Farrah 11. Fawcett as well. Exactly. I think that's what wrongfoots you about it, because this is 1980, so we're coming off the back of punk. And obviously you would have had, you know, people like Debbie Harry and Polystyrene, you know, singing songs and representing an attitude that was going against the grain in terms of sort of expectations of a certain kind and how you're meant to play your role as a woman in rock and roll. And that's what's so interesting about Sue Wilkinson, particularly in the one where she's wearing the pastel jumpsuit with the Farrah Fawcett hair, is that she comes on, she sings this incredibly biting song, but she's, you know, she's not presenting herself as punk. She's presenting herself like someone who you might see as a kind of pinup. See what I mean?
Yeah, and I think possibly we can get into this. Maybe a thing that dogs her chances and career, from what little I can find out about her, because she remains very enigmatic in terms of the amount of information out there. Yeah, it's worth perhaps having a look at the charts of what, in terms of the female performers that were around when she was in the charts. When she got to number 25, I had a look at the week of that. And if I'm just scanning down it now, we have, I mean, it's a chart that has Ashes to Ashes by David Bowie at number one. But we've got Sheena Easton at number three with a song called 9 to 5, which is almost the polar opposite of this, which is all about a woman waiting for a man to come home.
Yes, completely. It's one of the most, I've never been able to decide whether it's unintentionally uninspiring sounding, that song, because it really is very uninspiring. And it's got like a line, sort of lines in it about, yeah, I wrote it down, stretching and yawning, another day ahead, it seems to last forever and time goes slowly by. So even though it's this, you know, this kind of jaunty song about waiting for the man to come home, there's this sort of underlying feeling to that song, I think, that while she's waiting for him, she's incredibly bored.
Well, we've got Sheena Easton, we've got ABBA, we've got Kelly Marie doing Feels Like I'm in Love. I mean, Diana Ross is in there, and we've got people like Hazel O'Connor, and we go down, we find Sue Wilkinson sandwiched between Grace Jones and Bad Manners. So it's an interesting time. There's some significant female performers. And you've got people like Roxy Music are in there as well, Gary Newman. So you know the sound of the period's very well represented. And this is sat there, like I say, sandwiched between Grace Jones and Bad Manners, sounding like nothing else on earth.
Completely.
Yeah.
I mean, it's the Grace Jones one. Is that Private Life?
It is Private Life by Grace Jones, yeah.
Yeah, because even that has a sort of, there's an element of that, I think, maybe, that's kind of thematically kind of similar, where she seems to be kind of quite bored. I've never been quite sure who the song is sort of addressed to, but it might be her married lover, and she's basically telling him that she doesn't want to hear about his bad marriage and the problems with his sex life. And it's all this sort of, you know, even though it's stylistically quite different, there's quite a few kind of women sort of expressing feelings about what makes up their personal lives or their working lives, with this general sort of feeling of kind of, I don't know, dejection going on behind it. But you're so right about how she really stands out, because it's not as if she feels part of the kind of Blitz Kids movement, in which case you'd be able to sort of say about her, you know, that she's sort of part of that sort of school of thought that are kind of rejecting, you know, the sort of pre-assigned gender roles, and they're wanting to kind of find a different way of living. It's almost like she's presenting herself, maybe, I don't know what you think, but in the song, maybe it feels as if she is possibly a housewife, or maybe not, maybe a single woman, but someone who feels not part of a kind of, you know, exciting subculture, not someone who feels slightly as if they've missed the boat. I mean, in terms of the character she's playing, you know, and that's sort of part of why she presents herself in this kind of jumpsuit, and she's not trying to seem cool.
Yeah, it's definitely a character piece, I think.
Yeah.
And there's an album that this comes from as well, which seems to be full of similar sorts of things, of different types of characters. In fact, the B-side of this is called Double Dealing Day, and in that she's playing a sort of country and western style housewife waiting for a man to come home.
Oh,
and
yeah.
So that's got parallels with that Sheena Easton one as well, in fact. But she does that very much in a, as an American character.
Right, right, yeah. All day long he's been busy making money for me. Yes, he has. All day long his clever brain keeps scheming with such intricacy. Those hard-boiled bankers all acting so grand. They talk high finance, which I don't understand. So there's nothing
And then the front cover of the single that we're talking about, it's just a sort of head and shoulders shot of her looking bored whilst holding a stiletto shoe.
Yeah, I love that cover.
Yeah.
She's great. Yeah, well, I listened to some of her album.
Hmm.
Quite a few of the songs in it are character pieces, aren't they? Like there's one called Toy Boys, which seems to be kind of addressed to maybe a condescending older lover, and she's telling him that she's going to get a younger man instead, you know.
Yeah.
And sort of subverting in the kind of usual power dynamic there. And then there's also one called Yesterday's Alice, which I thought sounded quite like a sort of Dorrie Previn song. And that's about how a female friend of hers has sort of become bitter during the course of her life, and she married for money rather than for love, and this has sort of meant that she's just become this incredibly acerbic kind of person who has nothing but negative things to say about other people, and she's finding it really difficult to be around her because of her negative energy. Yesterday's Alice, why did you change? All your opinions are now rearranged. You used to stand tall, now your mind's become small, and I don't wish to call you my friend anymore. Yes, that's a strange one, Yesterday's Alice, which is sounds like a folk song but with on a piano. Yeah.
And it's very much about removing these people with negative energy from it, or being sad that people change. And it's a funny thing if you think about the rise of social media, and particularly the last couple of years of Twitter, where people seem to be leaping onto causes that are might be something technological like Bitcoin, or it might be a political thing. And it's like, well, why are you doing that? I mean, you're seeing it played out. And this is talking about the on a personal level back in, you know, the early 80s. So there's a lot of these songs that we'll talk about quite resonant, I think, today for a whole bunch of reasons.
Completely.
Yeah. So what did you know about Sue Wilkinson, or rather, what have you found out about Sue Wilkinson from what little there is out there?
Well, I found out that she was a songwriter in the 70s, and that she'd been signed by Chas Chandler from The Animals, and he'd managed Slade and Jimi Hendrix as well. And then also that the song was originally called You've Got to Be a Scrubber If You Want to Get On. But then the executive producer of Radio 1, Doreen Davis, advised her to tone down the language if she wanted it to get airplay. And there's quite a significant alteration in some of the lyrics. Like in the chorus, it's meant to be, the line is meant to be about women lying down and faking it.
Yeah.
But the line, yeah, it becomes something else, doesn't it? Yeah, it becomes... yeah.
Well, yeah, it's a censored version essentially that we're talking about. The single's a censored version, so it would get some airplay, like you say.
Yeah.
And it's good that they were advised to do this to get any airplay. And one thing I've not mentioned, of course, is actually this, like you say, yeah, Cheapskate Records is owned by Chas Chandler, but it's an independent record label. This is not a big production on some massive record label. And Polydor isn't putting this out or anything. And, you know, it's produced by a lady called Tricia O'Keefe. They put 1,000 copies out for promotional purposes to get it going.
Yeah.
So it's very small scale for the period. And yeah, it gets in the hand of Kenny Everett.
Yes, Kenny Everett, yeah. Played it a lot.
Which is marvellous because, yeah, just the sort of person who would play something like this would see the humour in it, understand the purpose behind it.
Yes, and then you've got Don Powell from Slade standing next to a drum kit that he doesn't play during those performances as well, on top of the parts.
Yeah, that's one of the first things that get mentioned when you look this up, is people go, oh, I remember that song, Don Powell plays on it. But of course he doesn't actually play on it, he was just brought in to it's like, what can we do to try and improve Sue's chances when she goes on Top of the Pops? We'll get the drummer from Slade to sit next to her with a he has like a gyro shaker thing and a whip noise thing to simulate what's, I believe it's supposed to be the sound of bed springs springing.
Oh, is it? I love that little noise.
Yes, I believe it is just a twanging ruler.
Oh, right. Okay. Great. The only women making it are women who are shaking it, forsaking all their morals on the map. It's an act, that's a
fact. You've got to be a hustler if you want to make a name. You know, a classic sound, that twanging ruler. So in terms of novelty songs, you know, one thing I like in novelty songs is when they've got sound effects in, and this does have a lot of sound effects in. Well, not a lot. It has the twanging ruler, significant. It has significant sound effects. It has the twanging ruler, and it has this amazing little bit with like either a tambourine or a hi-hat that's used to represent typewriter keys.
Oh, wow.
As well, when she's talking about the book.
Yes.
The woman writing the book.
Yes, and then with the interviews, the little speeded up voice as well.
So yeah. A lot of little funny bits like that.
Yeah.
But yeah.
Yeah, it's I don't know what you thought, but there's something about that performance, I think, the first time I saw it, that reminded me a little bit of Sparks.
Oh, yes, yeah. Yeah, someone with a synthesizer, someone stood stock still.
And kind of, you know, it has that slightly eerie feeling about it that some of those performances by Sparks around that you know, in the 70s have when you see them on Top of the Pops. And again, quite their stuff can be lyrically sort of similar, really, you know, quite dexterous and quite unusual with some of the subject matters they pick sometimes.
Yeah, and it is a sparse synthy keyboardy production, which is another amazing thing, because it's all sort of stripped back to allow the voice, because there's a lot of words. It's a fast thing for her to deliver, and to deliver crisply in the way that she does and get the story across, which is part of the sort of thing that stands out from seeing the performance or hearing the record, I think, is one of the big hooks. Certainly I felt from hearing it first off, it's like, how many words is she getting out there at that speed? It's insane.
Completely. There's a song from Sondheim's musical Company that's from earlier on in the 70s that's called Not Getting Married Today, and it's this woman basically having a kind of panic attack in right before she's meant to be getting married. And it's quite, stylistically, it's quite similar to this, and it has the same reaction to the one you just described, where you're kind of thinking, how are they managing to do this? How are they managing to fit in this much narrative into such a short space of time?
Pardon me, is everybody there? Because if everybody's there, I want to thank you all for coming to the wedding. I'd appreciate you going even more. I mean, you must have lots of better things to do, and not a word of it to Paul. Remember, Paul, you know the man I'm going to marry, but I'm not, because I wouldn't ruin anyone as wonderful as he is. But I thank you all for the gifts and the flowers. Thank you all. Now it's back to the showers. Don't tell Paul, but I'm not getting married today.
You know, they're not wasting a word. They're not wasting a second of this record's length, you know.
Yeah.
Quite incredible.
So yeah, I was just looking at the lyrics because the censorship in this, the deliberate censorship. So the album version is the full original, not the scrubber version. They obviously just got rid of that with the demo, but it's the uncensored version of You Gotta Be a Hustler. And like, yeah, they've swapped out witch for bitch in the uncensored one, and that weird bit where she has to find a way of doing a radio friendly version of saying faking it whilst lying in the sack on their back.
Yeah.
And they say something about faking all their morals on the mat. It's an act. It's a fact. Which is, you know, it does the job of fitting in the syllables, but yeah. I don't know what the mat is all about.
Really. So darn rich, though they tell me she's a witch, but love is by the score. Do I have to tell you more? Oh, you've got to be a hustler if you want to get on. Principles can only hold you back. So darn rich, though they tell me she's a bitch, with lovers by the score. Do I have to tell you more? Oh, you've got to be a hustler if you want to get on. Principles can only hold you back. The only women making it are women who are taking it or faking it while lying in the sack on their back in a sack.
No, it must have been. I mean, I've always been a bit perplexed about which they, I mean, I'm sure there's a whole rationale behind it that I just don't know about, but about which things in this period were allowed and which weren't lyrically, because at the same time, you know, this year you have Too Much Too Young by the Specials, and you know, which to this day, I mean, I am a Specials fan, so I've been to Specials gigs, and you know, you have just like these huge rooms of predominantly men kind of roaring along to Too Much Too Young. This song, you know, basically delivered to a woman about kind of the fact that she should have used contraception, you know.
Yeah.
And you've got everyone roaring, try wearing a cap and things. And I know that they wouldn't necessarily have put that bit on when they were playing it on the radio and stuff then. But still, sort of the subject matter of the song is quite out there, you know. But there's something interesting, I think, about how Sue Wilkinson was sort of told that she couldn't mention something like faking it, even though kind of that's still sort of quite oblique in some ways. But there was obviously something where people just sort of thought, no, don't go there, don't go there. We don't want people, you know, we don't want people dwelling on that. So that's quite interesting, isn't it? Which things are okay and which things aren't.
Yeah, and they cut out the word hooker from the sort of final verse, and she sort of does the, and now they're making a film of the book, and no one gives a damn that the girl was there, and she goes, huh.
Yes.
On the censored version, but on the album version, she just says hooker.
Yes.
Yeah. I think one of the funny things with this is if this was done on, say, as a feature slot on a comedy show, I don't think they'd censor it. I think you'd do it as a full thing.
Yeah, I think you're right.
But because it's a single to be sold.
Yeah.
It's because one of the things it did remind me of very early on, it doesn't sound anything like, but it made me think of Victoria Wood.
Yes, yes.
And the songs that she does, which are little slices of life, and sometimes they can be, obviously, the big daft ballad of Freedom and Barry type thing, or you've got some of these more heart-rending things. And this feels like it sort of exists in that world a little bit. And if she'd have had perhaps her own TV show, every single one of the songs on her album would have been a featured thing.
Yes, I think that's right. No, it's a shame that she couldn't be, because she was an actor and a model, I think, so she would have been. And you can tell from this performance that she's a good, you know, she knows how to act her characters. It also reminded me a bit of a song called 15 Minutes by Kirsty MacColl that comes at the end of the 80s, which is sort of about, you know, the thing of people chasing fame in a kind of depressing way. It's sort of, so the subject matter is quite similar. And I think I first saw that song, strangely enough, performed on an episode of French and Saunders.
Yes.
So it has that thing that you're talking about, that has that same sort of feeling to it, the Victoria Wood one.
Yeah, it's a great comedy song. One of the ones you mentioned before, in fact, Toy Boys, which she does on this album, which is called Looking for Cover in 1980. Toy Boys actually turns up as one of her singles in 1987.
Oh, really?
Quite a while after she tried to do these first four singles, of which only this one became a hit. But also, on a linked to Victoria Wood type way, Julie Walters had put out Toy Boys as a single as well.
Oh, that's amazing. Oh, I didn't know that.
Which I was very pleased when I discovered that, and it sort of worked, it sort of joined up my thinking a little bit.
Yeah.
Of that. So, yeah. But can I find a copy of Julie Walters doing Toy Boys? No, I can't. So if anyone out there has got it.
Oh, that's so annoying. Yeah.
You know, let me know.
Yeah, I'd also love to know where I could get my hands on a copy of the album. I really like it. I think it's really interesting. There's lots of different styles going on in it. And and I like there's a song in it called Women Only, which is another, I wrote down some lyrics. Over the years, we tried so hard to get some performance from men, from strippers in films and 38 bus and looking the best that we can. But then he goes to bed without brushing his teeth. And if he goes to sleep, that's okay. Ain't it a shame if we did the same, he'd find a replacement the very next day. It's like lots of these lovely, you know, kind of very funny, incredibly, incredibly sort of biting lyrics, though. Yeah, I think they're really good. Also, that song sounds like Biology by Girls Aloud.
I think it really is
a super song. So I think maybe the Xenomania team knew about Sue Wilkinson.
Actor, servant, and mother, and playmate of the year. women's pride.
Well, it'd be nice to think so, because obviously, yeah, like we've been saying, there's not much to find out about her. She puts this album out looking for cover with the You Gotta Be a Hustler as the lead single off it, which does well, as we're discussing. Then we have a single called Posers, Time and Tide, Women Only a few years later. Or Women Only 1981, Toy Boys a few years later. And then really, there's not much else. She's done something called Victim of the Planets, under the name of Big Dipper and the Heavenly Delights, which is like a disco song themed around star signs.
Oh, wow.
Which seems... It's a jolly enough thing, and there's like a 12-inch version you can listen to. It goes on for ages, but it feels quite like a cynical thing of like a combining star signs and disco and just having this... It feels like a good cash-in that obviously didn't get anywhere.
Yeah. Oh, God, but that's really interesting.
You know, having sexy Sagittarius in there, so, sort of phrases.
Yeah. Aquarius. I'll be a friend and a mother and a sister to you, brother, but oh, what a lover. Pisces. Romance and rhyme, I'll fill your time on a dreamy sign. Aries. I'm full of fire and warm desire, never tired. Taurus. I'll blow your horn and keep you warm, I'm a loving storm. Gemini. If pleasure is your and then, yeah, she put an album out in 2001.
Called Mood Swings by Hot Tea with Sue Wilkinson. And that's sort of a, listed everywhere as a comedy album. She wrote a book called Reflections of a Recovering Bimbo, which was a collection of poems, stories and lyrics. Which,
I'd love to read that book.
Yeah, me too. It sounds fascinating.
I heard the song from that album. I heard When I Was a Bimbo from that album, which is another really sort of interesting... I noted down some lyrics again. So I'm just a little more mature. I've traded in my tacky for demure, but I'm afraid I'm more or less ignored. I miss the attention I used to get before. When I was a bimbo, life was so easy. By just acting sleazy, I got everything. I do mean everything I wanted. Now I am sophisticated, showing my intelligence. I'm treated like a lady. I'm so elegantly, elegantly, elegantly celibate.
Yeah. I'm assuming it's quite autobiographical as much as anything.
Yeah, so. I mean, I really like the dry humour of her songs, you know, I think. And they're quite, they all feel kind of quite self-reflective, and that's always, yeah. That's always nice. Yeah, so very, very non-preachy, you know what I mean? Just very, very kind of honest about whether it be a character-driven piece or whether it be something that feels a little bit more kind of close to what she might have been experiencing. They're all... They give you a bit of insight, don't they?
And so she eventually apparently moves to Nashville and sort of works with songwriters and writes a lot of jingles, which can be quite a lucrative thing. So,
yeah.
But sadly, the story ends in 2005 after she's been diagnosed with breast cancer and comes back to the UK and sadly dies. So she's not around to be celebrated now. And I think perhaps with those performances that are being repeated in Top of the Pops, perhaps people would have loved to have asked her questions about it, about the songs, perhaps, you know. So it's quite sad that she missed out, you know, by dying in 2005 on the way sort of the internet might have made her into a sort of cult figure.
Oh, completely.
Or celebrated her more.
Definitely, definitely. I think that I was thinking when I was listening to her music that I would have really liked to have been able to get my hands on that album and to put some of those songs onto things like mixtapes and stuff that I'd made for people through the years, because I know so many people that would appreciate that kind of humour and you know, yeah. So it's really sad that she died so young.
Yeah. And I found a little article in Smash Hits magazine from August of 1980 as part of the promo for this. And it's just a little sort of roundup of who she is. She says, saying, Miss Wilkinson has previously worked as an actress and model under the name of Sue England, appearing in such major dramatic productions as General Hospital.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. And then it talks about the song being called You've Got to Be a Scrubber, but then changing it. And then it publishes the lyrics, as Smash Hits and other magazines often did. But it publishes the lyrics to the uncensored version.
Really?
So you've got, you know, bitches and hookers in there for your kids reading Smash Hits.
That's incredible.
In 1980.
Oh, how funny. Oh, wow. That was a bit of a slip up on their part, isn't it?
Yeah. But, I mean, let's get back to this song here. I mean, the thing that we've got to try and work out, and it's kind of... I don't know, is it? It's not for me to say necessarily, but as a woman listening to it, and it's just because it's a song about a woman commenting on a woman.
Mm.
Now, but because it's a comedy record, and is it parodying it? What's the message there? Is it useful? Is it relevant?
Do you mean relevant now?
Well, whatever. Was it ever relevant?
I think part of the reason why you get pulled in by the performance is because it leaves you thinking like all great art. It's it makes you maybe feel a bit uncomfortable, and it leaves you kind of reflecting on it. And I think that it does two things simultaneously, where it feels to me like it's a pastiche of women doing something that we like to call bitching.
Yep.
So it definitely feels as if there's a little bit of poking fun at the way women can gossip about other women, you know, particularly women that they're envious of for one reason or another. But then I also think, particularly in the chorus, I think part of the reason why the chorus is so punchy and stays in your head is because it is delivering a point that people can relate to. And I don't think it is specifically just, even though I know the song frames it as just being to do with women, I think that today we'd also sort of understand that it could be delivered in either direction, in the sense I see people talking about it on Twitter quite a lot, but quite often extremely successful people may have come from extremely successful families, or they may have married other people that may be helping them to have either become successful or to remain successful, if you see what I mean. So that there's a little bit of that feeling, I think, that we all know going through life, that if, you know, that kind of balance of you want to be a good person, you want to have morals and principles, but then everyone also has this strand in themselves to varying degrees of, you know, greed and narcissism, and you might know that if you got together with the right person, that they might be able to help you. If you made friends with the right person, or if you came from a certain kind of family, that they might be able to, you know, and just sort of managing those kind of feelings of greed and not wanting them to kind of take over yourself. So I think there's something in that chorus that sort of touches on that, and everyone recognizes it as something they might have either seen in themselves or seen in someone else. What do you think?
Yeah. Well, I was pondering then, as you were sort of discussing that of course we've had, well, I mean, there's lots of issues bound up in this, but the issue with Meghan Markle recently and the way she's being portrayed from different areas, some aspects of the media, you know, and lots of other people as well. There's plenty of essentially what they'd call, I don't know, gold digger syndrome, isn't there? A lot of people assuming, and it tends to work only that it's piled onto women.
Completely.
Men who hook up with famous women aren't sort of pilloried in the same way.
No, I mean, I noticed that with someone like with a couple like the Beckhams, for instance. I think that it became, the narrative quite quickly became that Victoria Beckham had got together with David Beckham for his fame, when in actual fact, I'm old enough to remember when they got together and she was the more famous one, if you see what I mean. So people are very quick to reevaluate a kind of narrative between men and women to kind of make it seem as if it's the woman that's doing all the chasing. And I think just as often it could be the man, you know. So.
Yeah. Yes, it's a shame she's not around to comment on this as well. I mean, if you look through the tracks on the album, some of the titles, not all of them, I won't read them all out, but you've got things like Extramarital Affair is the name of a track. You've got I Can't Stand a Night Without You, No One's Making Love Anymore, Women Only, Bad Loser, Moment of Glory. And you've got other songs on B-sides called things like Hollywood Chic, as in shake, chic, you know.
Yeah.
However you want to pronounce that to get the joke across.
Yeah.
Rich Man's Son. So clearly she's picking apart this issue that's troubling her as the years go by. And yeah, I think there is that strange thing about her appearance, of her calling herself a recovering bimbo in later years. And she's got, you know, like I say, this big blonde hair. And I bet she did spend a lot of time being doubted, maybe, probably being thought of as not as intelligent or as clever or creative as she probably was, because she wrote all this stuff. This isn't stuff she's bought in or got someone to write, you know.
Completely.
This is amazing stuff.
But I think that's, in a way, that's quite good. You know, I like the way she didn't, you know, if that's the image that she wanted to present, and if that's the image that suits her, I like how it wrong puts you in that way. There shouldn't be a thing where you say, you know, oh, if you're going to come on and do, well, you know, if you're going to write a song and tell us something that you think, then that means that you have to wear this kind of outfit, or you have to, you know, you're not allowed to wear pastel colours or something. I quite like the way she's kind of breaking the rules with that performance, I think.
And I think just as we get towards summing up, really, we must mention, I said the name before, Trisha O'Keefe, who was the producer of this song. And I think this is part of the great thing, that it's a female producer producing a female songwriter, singer-songwriter as well.
Yeah.
And the fact that it was her putting her own money, this is Trisha O'Keefe, putting her own money in to get this song recorded because she believed in it straight away, which is fantastic. I love the independent nature of this production.
That is fantastic.
Yeah. But it is a shame that perhaps that meant that it didn't get the attention it deserved. There wasn't the weight of the sort of the advertising and all that push that you would have had with a bigger label. That's a shame.
No, it is a shame.
Yeah, we must say thank you to Trisha O'Keefe for enabling her to actually get this music out there.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, it's also like just the when this song comes, it's the end of the 70s, you know, and you would have had like the Germaine Greer's The Female Eunuch being published at the beginning of the 70s. And there's quite a lot in that book about the kind of roles that women are given when they do go into the world of work, and, you know, like how a lot of what women have to do, which is reflected in 9 to 5 by Dolly Parton, which is out in this same year. You have, you know, a lot of them are kind of made to be secretaries that are kind of there to sort of flatter their boss's ego and kind of not put, you know, not kind of get ideas above themselves. And in 9 to 5, you have Dolly Parton talking about how, you know, she can't get a promotion and how they use your mind, but they don't give you credit. And,
yeah,
you know, there's a lot of that, a lot about that kind of frustration being expressed around that time. And also in The Female Eunuch as well, there is quite a lot about how actors and models, if you're a woman, you want to be an actress or a model, how badly you're treated and how, you know, how pay comes really late and you're kind of told to kind of completely kind of alter your appearance and this, that, the other. And so Sue, because she was an actress and a model as well as being a songwriter, she might have experienced some of those things as well, which might be reflected in some of these songs, some of the tone that creeps into it.
By dating someone famous, she makes herself a name, and no one blames her. I guess we'd all do the same. But then they get married, and before you know, she wants divorce and half of his dough. Gets herself a lawyer who's a really shrewd guy, and gets a judge's sympathy by crying and crying. Yes, you've got to be a hustler if you want to get on.
Yeah, okay. Well, to finish off then, make a pitch for this song. How are you going to convince people to listen to this other than simply directing them to this podcast?
I think it's just these couple of minutes of like really, you know, that there's like this biting comic pithiness, and it's really bizarre and really satisfying, and you can look at it in a myriad of different ways. And you can make up your own mind what you want to take away from it, but it really grips you and you can't take your eyes away from it.
Everyone should watch the Top of the Pops performances, because they're a fascinating article in and of themselves, and they deserve to be more than just that was a bit weird when it goes past you on BBC 4 one day. She really does deserve looking a little further into after that as well. So I will say then, for bringing along You've Gotta Be a Hustler If You Want to Get On by Sue Wilkinson, thank you very much, Catherine.
Thank you so much, Paul.
Yes, you've got to be a hustler if you want to get on.